we are going to be discussing in our lesson this evening, Solomon, the third king of Israel. And Josh is handing everyone out this evening's handout. This is Wednesday evening. We've been very fortunate this week. We've had a number of young families with children from other places have been visiting with us. But it's just us tonight, so I think that we have good material to cover. Sometimes people will say, you know, Stan, you preached a good lesson, and I always say, well, it's hard to go wrong with good material, and that's certainly the case with regard to Solomon. There's an awful lot that we can learn from his life and his reign as king over Israel. I think that you'll enjoy the time that we spend looking at him, character study of his life. I appreciate very much that Dennis has done such a fine job with his two nights. In fact, so much so that I told him I wish I could just continue to sit in the class and listen to him teach. He does such a good job. And so I do very much appreciate that. When we talk this evening, we're going to have a little bit less material to cover than with Saul and David. There's just not quite as much in the text of 1 Kings chapter 1 through 11, 2 Chronicles chapter 1 through 11, the material that we have, Solomon's reign and life, but it's still too much to cover in one evening. So when we get to tomorrow evening with Josiah, then we'll have quite a bit less, so we can cover that a bit more fully. Of course, on Friday night, we're going to be talking about Jesus. And I do want to spend some time pointing out the tie-in is Jesus as a king and as a king from the tribe of Judah, and revisit a little bit that covenant that was established with David by God, as we read yesterday in 2 Samuel chapter 7. I'd like you to turn with me over there again very quickly. 2 Samuel chapter 7. And in the midst of that that covenant that God made with David, I want you to notice in verse 11, this is something that Dennis referred to yesterday, where in the latter part of that verse, we're told that the Lord tells you that He will make you a house. And then when we talk about that house, that we're talking about the establishing of this dynasty, that the sons of David would remain on the throne of Judah. And of course, we know Christ as being a son of David. Now, thinking again with regard to the history of the Jewish people up to this point in time, they had spent that time in wandering in the wilderness, wilderness of Judea, following Moses, their lawgiver. And then after they had taken the land for a period of time, they were under what is referred to as the rule of the judges. In reality, though judges were raised up from time to time, times of distress and duress in Israel, and this was a time where God ruled over them. And as you remember, they rejected God as their ruler. The other nations round about, they wanted to have kings. And so God granted them King Saul as the first king. Samuel, you'll remember, was very upset at the clamoring for the king, but God told him, let them have what they want, that they have not rejected you, Samuel being the final judge in Israel. He said, they have not rejected you, they have rejected me. So they desired, clamored to be like the nations round about. It's kind of a peculiar thing, because it is something, again, we're going to seek to make some applications as we go through and discuss these things. You can see that among God's people today, at least some, who are clamoring or desiring to be like those without. It can be seen with regard to, let's say, the willingness to lower standards of morality to be like those who are in the world, standards of modesty or behavior. It can be seen with regard to the clamoring of some in the church to be like the denominations. The social gospel among God's people, to a very great extent, had its genesis in a desire to be like the denominations. to experience the growth and the dynamic growth that the denominations were experiencing. And so they sought to mimic those things. It's always a bad idea to try to be like those who are without. We're always supposed to remember ourselves as a peculiar people. And there's no great difference between that and Israel. Israel had been given directions to destroy the inhabitants of the land utterly. They didn't do it. Idolatry was a problem in Israel from the very beginning and continued because of their unwillingness to do God's command. And those influences were seen in the fact that Saul first reigned as king in Israel. Now, as again, I didn't have the benefit of being here Monday night in the discussion of Saul, but the allusions to it yesterday evening indicated very clearly that Saul was a failure as king, that though he had some characteristics that the people of the world would think to be positive, that in reality he was lacking in character, and that became obvious as he reigned over Israel, and especially with regard to his paranoia and his jealousies of David. But David was a man after God's own heart, and that promise here was given as a result of David's reign and the goodness of him as a person. Again, we understand that he's not perfect, but he did have many good attributes. That God had promised his house, his dynasty would be established. And of course, the latter part of that particular promise that is given there in verse 12 and following, we find the fulfillment of the messianic aspect in Christ Jesus. And the first allusions to that with regard to David's house and David's throne given here in this particular text. When your days are fulfilled, you rest with your fathers, I will set your seed up after you, who will come from your body and establish his kingdom, and he shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. And we'll talk more about this on Friday as we correlate that promise with, for example, the events of Acts chapter 2, as the promise of the resurrected Christ and the establishment of his kingdom is fulfilled. But what we have now is the second, or the next in line following David, and that, of course, was his son Solomon. Now, remember that Solomon was not the only son of David. He had other sons, some that we mentioned in our study yesterday evening. Amnon, as an example, who was murdered by Absalom, is recorded in 2 Samuel chapter 13. You'll remember as well that Absalom himself attempted through treachery to gain the kingdom and to depose his father David. He was unsuccessful in this, which led to his defeat and his death. And so these two individuals are dead. Absalom's younger brother actually comes into the narrative when we get into a discussion of Solomon's ascension to the throne, because Absalom's younger brother, also the son of Haggith, his name is Adonijah. And I don't know if I pronounced that correctly or not, but that's the way I've always pronounced it, Adonijah. He sought to usurp that throne, though God had determined that it would be Solomon who would reign after David. You'll remember the promise when David sought to establish a temple, to build a temple, and God told him, because you are a man of war, you will not build the temple, but your son Solomon, it will be built during his reign. So he was the one that was chosen by God to reign as king over Israel. But I do want you to note, just very quickly, a couple of things. I want you to notice in 2 Samuel, the 12th chapter. 2 Samuel chapter 12. Now, this was after the death of David and Bathsheba's first son, which again we talked about in the lesson yesterday. An unnamed son. We don't know what he was named, but he died as an infant. And after that, we're told in verse 24 that David comforted Bathsheba, his wife, and went into her and lay with her, and she bore a son, and he called his name Solomon. Notice this phrase here, now the Lord loved him. I was reading it in the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia this afternoon, just kind of going over the material about Solomon, and it talked about how blessed Solomon was. I mean, you think about if any child ever lived a life of privilege, you hear about the silver spoon in your mouth. His spoon wasn't silver, it was gold. I mean, everything. He was the son of David. He was the chosen
of God. He was one whom the Lord loved. He was an individual who was raised in the lap of luxury. He was the child of David's favorite wife. His life was just a charmed life. And so as he ascended the throne, it's believed that he actually took the throne near the end of David's life, between the age of 14 and 18. Those are two different figures that I've been given. He's a very young man. Then, of course, you'll remember, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, the dream that he had, where he God appeared to him in that dream and asked him, "What do you want?" He asked for wisdom, which led God to grant not only wisdom, but also to grant him great, great wealth, wealth that no king had seen before. And so, in effect, what we have here, just in a third generation with regard to kings, the third king of Israel, we have, in fact, what is the apex of Israel's influence and strength and the boundary of the habitation of the land. The influence over the surrounding peoples, it reached its zenith at the time of Solomon's rule and reign. His glory, his splendor was something that the world had never seen. And Queen Sheba, we'll talk a little bit about that, comes into play in this discussion. So he was just an amazingly fortunate individual. Primarily, simply as a matter of happenstance, who he was, but also with regard to the choices that he made very, very early in his life, and as a result of the great blessings that God bestowed upon him. So what this lesson is to a certain extent a morality tale concerning how an individual can attain these wonderful things and can again reach such an apex or such a high level and standard, both with regard to wealth as well as with regard to the wisdom that he utilized as he was over the land, and then fall so precipitously as a result of ungodly influences. And this serves to we can say that if it could happen to Solomon, it could happen to anybody. And this individual of privilege did fall, as we'll see at the end of his life. So, if you'll notice, we do this with regard to all of the lessons. We seek to establish some of the positive attributes of Solomon, some of the negative attributes. I enjoyed the way that Dennis approached it in the lesson with regard to David, to try to kind of incorporate those characteristics and some of the major events in the life of David. We're going to try to do that a little bit this evening as well, as we discuss Solomon and some of those things that happened in his life. The first thing you'll notice in the outline under point one concerning his positive attributes, I put that he could be a merciful individual. And I think maybe the best way to put this would be an indication of his righteousness as a young man. He was a righteous individual. He was a fair individual. The fairness perhaps illustrated with regard to his judging between the two women who had the sole remaining child who was alive. But actually, in reading this particular account in 1 Kings chapter 1, as we get into that section of our study, this ISBE, the International Bible Encyclopedia, was critical of Solomon on this particular occasion when he initially granted, in effect, pardon to his brother, his half brother, but then later put him to death. And I use that actually to indicate his merciful nature. And so there are two ways of looking at this. I think my way is right, but I did want to acknowledge that some felt differently. And so this is the point that is made. Adonijah, brother, half-brother, had sought to usurp the throne. David was nearing the end of his life. And it's obvious as you look at the narrative that David was infirm. He was not aware of what was going on at this point in time in his kingdom. And Adonijah took some of the most influential of Israel and basically crowned himself as king. And they were in the midst of celebrating the fact that he was king of Israel, and Bathsheba was aware of it, and Nathan the prophet, and they went to King David and told David, "You promised that Solomon would be king, And if you don't fulfill this promise that you have given, that Solomon would be king, then what would happen? And it's very typical of that time, a consolidation of a reign. Solomon and Bathsheba's lives were in danger if Adonijah was able to pull this off. And so David did as he had promised, and in fulfilling God's request in this, and made it known to the people that Solomon was the chosen one, and David himself anointed Solomon as king, which led, in effect, to the overtaking of Adonijah's efforts to usurp the throne. And as a result of that, when it became very obvious that that Solomon would be king, that Adonijah was afraid as a result of that, thinking that he would be killed. And I want you to notice the petition that he made in verses 50 of 1 Kings chapter 1. He was afraid of Solomon and rose and went to hold the horns of the altar. And it was told Solomon, saying, Adonijah is afraid of King Solomon, for look, he has taken hold of the horns of the altar, saying, let King Solomon swear to me today that he will not put his servant to death with a sword. And then notice Solomon's statement. He had already expressed treachery. This was not something that was not known, that Solomon was the chosen one. It was an act of treason, in fact. It was a power grab that's very typical that Adonijah had done. But Solomon answered and said, if he proves himself a worthy man, not one hair of him shall fall to the earth, but if wickedness is found in him, he shall die. So King Solomon sent them to bring him down from the altar. And he came and fell down before King Solomon. And Solomon said to him, go to your house. And so, initially, he let Adonijah go. That's where I got the concept of mercy and this righteousness or this fairness that was present in Solomon. Now, later on, Adonijah, through Bathsheba, the machinations, this attempt to get his way and his will, made a request that angered Solomon. And when that happened, Solomon cleaned house. He certainly did, which in fact David had told him to do so, and which led to the death of the priest and Joab, the man of valor, as well as Adonijah. They were all destroyed, and his throne was consolidated. But I do think, now the International Bible Encyclopedia said that just on the pretext or pretense of some imagined intrigue that Solomon did what he did. And I think that that's an unwarranted criticism. I think that that his actions here were valid based upon Adonijah's continued attempts to garner influence or to in some way take advantage of these situations. Perhaps even taking advantage of Bathsheba on this particular occasion. So, as a result of that, this did happen. But I do want to make note, at the very least, that early on in his reign as king, that Solomon was a righteous individual, a good person. Because, again, as his reign continued, and as the opportunity for corruption came in late in his life, he faltered greatly. But at least early on, there was this righteousness that was present. Okay, so anybody have any comments, questions before we get into the some of the major things? A couple that I want to talk about is that appeal for wisdom, as well as to spend a few moments talking about the building of the temple itself. So we want to get into those events and what they reveal about Solomon. Yes, Jerry?
We know why Solomon wanted this woman
his wife. Say that again.
Okay, Solomon wanted this woman his wife.
Right.
Why was Solomon
this? I don't know. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's why there's some... now, this was the handmaiden who had been brought to David in his old age. But that woman was one that he made request. Now, Bathsheba considered the request as being maybe a reasonable one, but Solomon did not. So as far as why... the thing that comes to my mind is that he sure was a forward individual, where he had just been begging for his life a short time ago, and now he's trying to get Bathsheba to make an appeal to the king on his behalf so he could get something he wanted. And it may very well be that that was sufficient, you know, that it just indicated a willingness to scheme to get what he wanted was indicating some wickedness on his part. Because you'll notice again, now this is, at the very least, Solomon's statement and his standard. He said in verse 53, or 52, if he proves himself a worthy man, then not one hair shall fall, but if wickedness is found in him, he shall die. So Solomon considered that request as a wicked request for whatever reason. And as a result of that, he destroyed, or he executed, or had Adonijah executed on that occasion. Anybody else? Okay, so what do we think of when we think of the reign of Solomon? I think we probably, it comes to mind three things. Number one, his prayer, his petition for wisdom. Number two, the building of the temple. And then number three, his heart being turned away by his many wives and concubines. I guess you could add his wealth in as a result of that. But we're gonna talk about that a little bit in conjunction with the request that he makes for wisdom. So let's go over now to 1 Kings chapter 3. 1 Kings chapter 3. And I want you to know, again, there may be some ignorance that is involved in this. We talked yesterday a little bit about the ignorance of the times. And we have a situation where we're told in verse 3 that Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father David, except that he sacrificed and burned incense at the high places. Now we know, you'll remember, later on, when Solomon's reign came to an end, that Jeroboam, which was his servant who had rebelled and taken with him the 10 northern tribes, that he erected and maintained those high places north in Israel so that the people would not go to Jerusalem for the purpose of worshiping God. So here is an example of Solomon doing that. And I think that that except is an indication that this is one thing that though it was done and did not in any way cause God to reject him, it was not something that was in accord with God's will. So this may have been an example like from Acts 17 where he said there are certain things that God allowed or God winked at in times past. As these things are being established, the temple had not yet been built, this offering of sacrifices, and not only this, it was an indication very clearly of his devotion, because he went to the high place there in Gibeon and offered, verse 4, 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. So he was at least very diligent, showed his ardor for God in the sacrifices that he offered. We're in 1 Kings chapter 4 here. But at Gibeon, verse 5, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night. And God said, "Ask, what shall I give you?" And Solomon said, "You've shown great mercy to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in truth, in righteousness, and uprightness of heart with you. You have continued this great kindness for him. You have given him a son to sit on his throne as it is this day. Now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king instead of my father David, but I am a little child." Again, we'll note it's hard to determine exactly his age, but somewhere in that range as a teenager, between 14 and 18 years of age. So this was a great burden that was placed upon him to taking over this nation at such a young age. He said that I am but a child. And so he said, "I do not know how to go out or come in, and your servant is in the midst of your people whom you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to be numbered or counted." Verse 9, "Therefore give to your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, that I may discern between good and evil, for who is able to judge this great people of yours?" I have no doubt that that this is one of the things in the youth classes, at least this evening, that will be emphasized, is his desire to serve God at a very young age. In fact, one of the reasons why Josiah was chosen as the fourth out of five, I mean, Saul, David, and Solomon are obvious choices, as is Jesus, as we see the fulfillment of prophecy, but I had to come up with a fourth king. Well, the reason I chose Josiah was one because he was a righteous king, but also because he served God as king in his youth and showed a great strength of character, moral character, even while he was young. I don't have to make this application to you guys because you're a bit older, but it is possible for an individual at a very young age to make right choices and to establish a strength in character, to be not just a follower, but rather a leader in his service to God and in the influence that he shows to others. The Apostle Paul gave the same instructions to Timothy as a young evangelist, and Titus as well. These sons in the faith, he sought to establish them in the faith, to encourage them to righteous living, and exhorted them to be good examples to those that they were following. So this is something that a young person can do. However, having said that, Solomon acknowledged and recognized that he was limited in his ability because of a lack of experience and because of his age. And so he asked God, when anything could be given to him, he asked God to grant him that understanding heart to judge between the people, that I may discern between good and evil. Well, in verse 10, we are told that what he said pleased the Lord. So Solomon had asked him not for long life for yourself, verse 11. Not asked for riches for yourself, ask the life of your enemies. You'll remember that David, we talked about the three choices that God gave to David as he was punished for the numbering of the people. And remember what David's request was? Somewhat selfish, just spare my life, do not let me fall into the hands of my enemies. That's not where Solomon was here. Solomon was very, very selfless in the request that he made. But as a result of that, verse 12, he said, "I have done according to your words. I have given you a wise and understanding heart, so that there has not been anyone like you before, nor shall any like you arise. I have also given you what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that there shall not be anyone like you among the kings all your days." And as we see, if you look at the life and the reign as it is related in these texts here in 1 Kings as well as the Chronicles, you find that's exactly the case. His reign far surpassed any other with regard to fame, with regard to influence, with regard to riches as a result of God's blessings that were bestowed upon him. And we'll read a little bit about it as well in just a few moments' time. But there is an important thing for us to consider here. You'll notice in verse 14 the statement, "If you walk," notice the word "if" there because that's key, "if you walk in my ways to keep my statutes and my commandments as your father David walked, then I will lengthen your days." And not only with regard to that particular request that was made by him and that promise. I want you to just very quickly go a few chapters over. At the time in which the temple was being built, in 1 Kings chapter 9. Because here we find what is referred to as the second appearance of God to Solomon. So now some time has passed. Some time has been spent in the building of all of these great edifices and building, including the temple itself. And after the building of the temple, as the people were gathered together, Solomon dedicated the temple. It's related in verse 62 of the previous chapter, chapter 8. And then there is the appearance of God in chapter 9. I want you to notice what is said in the first 9 verses there, in his second appearance. "It came to pass, when Solomon had finished building the house of the Lord, the king's house, that all Solomon's desire, which he wanted to do, that the Lord appeared to Solomon the second time, as he had appeared to him in Gibeon." We just read that. "The Lord said to him, I have heard your prayer and your supplication that you have made before me. I have consecrated this house which you have built to put my name there forever. And my eyes and my heart will be there perpetually. Now if you walk," again here's the "if," it's a conditional promise that he's granting to Solomon here. "If you walk before me as your father David walked, in integrity of heart and in uprightness to do according to all that I have commanded you, and if you keep my statutes and my judgments, then I will establish the throne of your kingdom over Israel forever, as I promised David your father, saying, you shall not fail to have a man on the throne of Israel. But if you or your sons at all turn from following me and do not keep my commandments and my statutes which I set before you, but go and serve other gods and worship them, Then I will cut off Israel from the land which I have given them, and this house which I have consecrated for my name I will cast out of my sight. Israel will be a proverb and a byword among all the peoples. And as for this house, this dynasty that David, he promised, would exist in perpetuity, he said, as for this house which is exalted, everyone who passes by will be astonished and will hiss and say, why has the Lord done thus to this land and to this house? And they will answer, because they forsook the Lord their God, who brought their fathers out of the land of Egypt, and have embraced other gods and worshipped them and served them. Therefore, the Lord has brought all this calamity on them. Now, of course, there is an important consideration in all of this, and that is that God always keeps His promises. So, when we find what happened with regard to Israel and Judah, what happened at the death of Solomon with regard to the division of the 10 northern tribes and the 2 southern tribes, you have to understand the reason why all of these things happened. Now David, his throne remained, and the tribe of Judah reigned in that southern kingdom throughout that time until Christ came, and he was the son of David. The messianic promise was fulfilled. But this great and glorious promise that existed during the reign of Solomon, and the promise granted that it would remain in perpetuity if they remain righteous, didn't even last to the end of his reign, his time as king over Israel, because of the fact that he did exactly what God said not to do, and that is he went over, went after those idols. And so the conditional nature of God's promises is something that we want to emphasize. And it's something that is borne out time and again throughout Scripture. We read Ezekiel 18. I want to touch upon it at the end of our time together this evening again. But you'll remember the statement that Jehovah God had made that Israel didn't consider fair, but he said, yes, it is fair. And that is that if a righteous man turns away from his righteousness, then he will be condemned. And an unrighteous man, if he turns to God and becomes righteous, then he will be rewarded. It's the way God works. It's the way He's always worked. It's the way He worked with all the kings. That's the way He's worked with regard to His people, which makes it so peculiar that the tremendously large percentage of religious people today think that He does not work that way today. And they have the idea that all I got to do is get the ball rolling in the right direction, and from that point on, it doesn't matter what I do or how I act, that once I'm saved, I'm always saved. That promise is something that will never falter, because after all, God made the promise. Yes, but the promise is always conditioned upon continued obedience. It was with regard to David. It was with regard to Solomon. And again, the people of Israel faltered again and again and again, which led to the northern kingdom of Israel being taken away into what captivity? Assyria's captivity. And then the southern kingdom of Judah into Babylonian captivity. And it was as a response, or as a result of, the response of Israel that was inappropriate. They became idolatrous. And as a result of that, God rejected them. It's one of those things, you just look at it and you think to yourself, Solomon, why did you do it? How could you do it? Look at what you've gotten. Look at how much you've enjoyed, how many blessings that you've received. How in the world could you give that up for these worthless stone images? But again, you see Christians doing that every day, don't you? Individuals who have received so many blessings from God, and yet they return back to the world. So it happens. Okay. It's the same problem I always have. I stop teaching, start preaching. Anybody want to add anything to what we've discussed so far? Okay, so we do have here at this point at least a partial discussion concerning the wisdom of Solomon. That he received this wisdom because he made that proper request. Now, but one thing I want to add to that concept of the king's ability to have a proper perspective and understanding is the account in 1 Kings chapter 3 and verse 16. The account of his wisdom. And this is a story that everyone knows very well. It is something that indicates a king's insight into human nature. You have two women, And as the scenario is explained in verse 17 by one of the women, there are two women in a house by themselves, just the two, both of them having given birth to two children. These were harlots, verse 16. So there were no men. It's just the two women with their two children. And so after 3 days given birth, verse 18, the woman also gave birth, and we're in the house together, no one with us except the two of us. And this woman's son died in the night because she lay on him. By the way, they say today you shouldn't sleep with your kids. For this very reason, actually. But there are individuals who decry the dangers of that because of the possibility of the child suffocating. So that's what happened in this particular case. And so in the middle of the night, this woman claims that the other lady, after she found her child dead, came and switched the babies. And then in the morning, she recognized that this was not her child. And then, of course, the other lady said, verse 22, "No, the living one is my son, and the dead one is your son." And the first woman said, "No, the dead one is your son, the living one is my son." And they spoke before the king. So what did the king say to do? Divide him in half. Each of you get half the living child. And kind of an insight. And now, some of us may think that the woman who was not the mother was very callous in saying, "Yeah, go ahead and divide him." But again, understand that woman was motivated by jealousy and envy in that case. And her love was not pure. But the woman who the child belonged to was willing to give up her child so that the child would live, thus indicating to Solomon that indeed she was the true mother of the child, and the child was granted to her. So here is an example. It's one that we've heard time and time and time again, and there have been morality plays that are made concerning this. But it does indicate a keen insight into human nature, and that indeed God had equipped Solomon well to serve as king, to adjudicate with regard to those kinds of differences and conflicts, and to serve and to reign wisely over his people. So that's the example that is given in the text, and it is a significant example of his wisdom. Any comments, questions about that particular account? Nobody? Okay. All right, well, then the next thing that I want to do is to look at the Queen of Sheba in 1 Kings chapter 10, to continue this idea of his wisdom. By the way, we are aware of the fact that the king, King Solomon, is the one who wrote the book of Proverbs, some of the most effective, pithy nuggets of wisdom that the world knows. It's a wonderful study. If you want to gain a great deal of practical application, take the time to study from the wisdom literature. It's a wonderful, wonderful study. Both the book of Proverbs as well as the book of Ecclesiastes. The book of Ecclesiastes, I believe, was also written by Solomon. He calls himself the son of David. Some deny that it was Solomon. I believe that it was. And again, the same thing. He had a position and place of great privilege, and he used that to experientially try everything there was to try to see what had value, and came to the conclusion that all in life without respect to God was vain. And man's purpose on earth, as Ecclesiastes 12 tells us, is to fear God and keep his commandments. So it's great wisdom that is found in the words of Solomon. And I would encourage you to take advantage of those words by reading and studying the book of Proverbs and the book of Ecclesiastes often. But this particular account was something that involves not only the blessing that Solomon directly asked for, but also the blessings that God gave him as a result of his very righteous request. Well, Queen of Sheba had heard a great deal about Solomon. So this was, he was a very famous individual. By the way, just to let you know, and it was in that book that I told you I was reading earlier, it's something that was pointed out. David, as we talked about last night, consolidated the kingdom. Even after the death of Saul, for a period of time, that first 7 years, he was in Hebron. And the kingdom was somewhat divided. until such time as he was able to consolidate it and establish his rule in Jerusalem. But throughout that period of time, you had a nomadic people who had traveled through the wilderness for all those generations and who had spent that time as they were in the days of the judges and warring. And now a monarchy has been established with Saul. But Saul basically was a military leader. David was the first great king. But even then, there was time that was spent in establishing, consolidating the kingdom. And as God told David, you're a warring king. So when you're talking about a cosmopolitan king, and a king that existed very much like the great Oriental emperors, Solomon was the first one. And it was during his time that the great wealth was amassed it was just amazing what he had received, that the temple was built. All of these things were accomplished during the reign of Solomon. And so, modernists will tell you that Solomon probably didn't even exist, and if he did exist, he was probably just a chieftain over a small group of people, and that everything that is found in the Bible is just hogwash. And I want you to note that there is not a great deal of archaeological findings for that period of time. But the fact that there's not a great deal, not saying that there isn't evidence, because there certainly is, but that the fact that there is not overwhelming indications is not the same as indicating that there's no validity to what is said. You will hear modernists do this time and time again. They do this, you know, the farther back in antiquity they go, the easier it is to make these claims. But even during the time of Christ, there are claims made that the narratives and the Gospels have absolutely no validity and veracity. I'll just give you one example with regard to Judas Iscariot, prelate of Judea. For years and years and years and years, modernists who denied the inspiration of Scripture said that it's obvious that the Bible is not inspired of God because no such individual as Judas Iscariot existed. Well, how do you know no such individual existed? Well, because there's no evidence that he existed. And so they reasoned from that, since there's no evidence, that he didn't exist, when in reality, they just hadn't uncovered it yet. And one of the most interesting things that I saw when I went to the Bible lands was in Caesarea Maritime, on the shore of the Mediterranean, where the Roman governors were. And there's a great arena there on the Mediterranean Sea. Well, they uncovered an actual inscription that stated that Pontius Pilate was prelate of Judea. And they have actually they don't have the original there on site. They secreted it away into some museum, but they do have a replica of it that's sitting there on the site, which gives not just a second-hand account, but the actual archaeological excavation of proof that Pontius Pilate served as prelate or governor of Judea in the time that the Bible narrative said that he did. And so you cannot equate a lack or a dearth of evidence or a paucity of evidence with the claims that are commonly made that since there's not a great deal that is known extra-biblically about these individuals, that the Bible narrative can't be right. It's simply not something that you can do. But it's the common argument that is made. The funny thing about it is that every time something is uncovered, it always seems to corroborate the narrative. And it has done it time and time again. And so you'll have the modernists that will take one more step back and say, well, maybe that's okay, but this isn't right. Or this isn't true. And they're having continually to do that as more and more things are uncovered. But as we look at the biblical record of the text in 1 Kings chapter 10, we are told that the Queen of Sheba heard the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord and came to test him with questions. And so she came and she asked him all of these questions, bringing the great retinue with her. In other words, she was going to bring him gifts. And notice verse 3, Solomon answered all her questions. There was nothing so difficult for the king that he could not explain it to her. Notice what the Queen of Sheba said. Now she saw all the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he had built, the food on his table, the seating of his servants, the service of his waiters, and their apparel, his cupbearers and his entryway by which he went into the house of the Lord, there was no more spirit in her. She was weak-kneed, is what that meant. She just physically was just absolutely unable to figure out how this possibly could be. It was just an amazing thing to her. So she said to the king, "It was a true report which I heard in my own land about your words and your wisdom. However, I didn't believe those words until I came and saw with my own eyes. And indeed, the half was not told me. Your wisdom and prosperity exceed the fame of which I heard. Happy are your men, and happy are these your servants, who stand continually before you and hear your wisdom. Blessed be the Lord your God, who delighted in you, setting you on the throne of Israel. Because the Lord has loved Israel forever, therefore he has made you king to do justice and righteousness." So there we see, just from the words of the Queen of Sheba, exactly what we sought to summarize up to this point in time with regard to his reign. The Lord loved him. Solomon was a privileged individual. It was the pinnacle of the kingdom of Israel during the time of his reign. So much so that half had not been told. And the Queen of Sheba was completely amazed at not only his wealth, which was the byproduct of his expressions or desire for wisdom, but the wisdom itself, his ability to explain. So Solomon was an amazing man in so many ways. And just as a wise king and a very effective ruler as a result of God's blessing him up to this point in time. So we do want to emphasize that, and how important that wisdom as well as the wealth were, as we see the history of Israel in this particular area. Now we're going to talk a little bit about the disappointing negative aspects of Solomon's life. Before we do, do any of you want to say anything about this, either the wealth, wisdom, this particular event with regard to Queen Sheba? Yes, sir.
I've heard two different theories about Queen Sheba from the first place, the later.
No thoughts on my part. Not there. I didn't dig into that sufficiently. I do know that the common view is it was Ethiopia. Yeah. Yeah. Anybody have anything want to add to it? Yes.
Just a simple thought. If you are prison or given wealth or come across wealth, it is a indicator of abandonment, it can be an indicator of character, and if wise loneliness, it can be an indicator of good character.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting thing, because you see it so often when with regard to rulers and people who are in a position of authority or rich people. You've heard the phrase, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. As far as I understand, wealth and power did not corrupt Solomon. And again, these things are byproducts of God's blessing. Now, you can't get the gospel of health and wealth from these passages. And I know some people try to ascertain that. I wish that people could see the difference between Solomon saying, money doesn't mean anything to me, all I want is wisdom. And because of that, God granting money. And then the preacher's coming along and say, hey, you give me some money, God will give you money. See, there it's all about money. It wasn't about money at all with regard to Solomon. And I don't think that Solomon was corrupted in any way by the fact that he had so much money or that he had so much power, though he was the most powerful and richest king that had ever held the throne, that would ever hold the throne. By the way, do keep in mind that right after his death, kingdom was divided. The northern kingdom didn't last very long after that before it was taken away into captivity. The southern kingdom consisted of those two southern tribes. There was never any approach to the glory that was present during the time of Solomon. In fact, you'll remember that as the remnant returned to the land and sought to rebuild the temple, how that the older people who remembered the temple of Solomon before it was destroyed, how sad they were because the temple that was going to be erected in its place was such a pale imitation of the glory that Solomon had when he erected that temple for God. So, you know, the problem was, though that's the case, in the case of Solomon, that's not what corrupted him. So it's an indication of his great character. He was a man of character. I think that the morality play, the story here, is that individuals who are good people can nevertheless be corrupted if the influence that they heed is sufficiently corrupt. And Paul tells us, if any man thinks he stands, let him take heed lest he fall. There's that danger always, that if you listen to the wrong counsel, that wrong counsel can lead you astray. And that's certainly the case with regard to Solomon. Anybody want to add anything with regard to his positive attributes before we talk a little bit about how he changed? Now, I don't want to give short shrift, but I think that we are going to run out of time before we get through all of this. I do not want to give short shrift in any way with regard to the importance of the building of the temple and the significance of this. If we were to say what was the most significant event in his reign, it would be the building of the temple. This nomadic people who had had a tabernacle up to that point in time now had a place that was established and centered in Jerusalem, that was the abode of God. And it was a wonderful thing. It was an indication of God's blessings upon the nation, of his choosing of Solomon, and how Solomon was a special individual. But again, we're not going to have enough of time to go into great detail about that. I would like to encourage you, however, to read, and this is found in 1 Kings chapter 5, going through chapter 8 of the text, to take the time to read about the grandeur, the splendor of the temple, and all the things that were erected in it. I do want you to very quickly look at a couple of things that are found in his speech in chapter 8 of the text before we go on. And just note the significance that Solomon himself attributed to the occasion of the building of the temple. In other words, it had been accomplished and now they were dedicating the temple. In verse 12, he spoke and said, "The Lord said he would dwell in the dark cloud. I have surely built you an exalted house and a place for you to dwell in forever." In verse 23 of the text, he said, "The Lord God of Israel, there is no God in heaven above or on earth below like you, who keep your covenant and mercy with your servants who walk before you with all their hearts. You have kept what you promised your servant David my father. You have both spoken with your mouth and fulfilled it with your hand, as it is this day." So everything that God had promised concerning David, Solomon acknowledged here on this particular occasion that he had indeed fulfilled. But even, again, just make note of it, even within this statement that you have fulfilled it, there is that realization, he said, that you give these things, you grant these covenants, you extend this mercy with your servants who walk before you with all their hearts. And that's an indication again of that conditional nature of their receiving the blessings of God. In other words, conditioned upon their obedience. So with that in mind, let's just take just a few moments and go now to 1 Kings chapter 11. 1 Kings chapter 11. It's an interesting thing if you look at the two major narratives that are contained in the Word of God concerning his reign. And we do have, of course, his own writings, but the historical narratives are found in 1 Kings 1 through 11 and then 2 Chronicles 1 through 9. And in the 2 Chronicles narrative, there is nothing that is said about Solomon turning away from God. So it's something that is basically just not observed. It's not noted in that place. So the one narrative that we have indicating that Solomon did not maintain his faithfulness to God throughout that reign, and explaining why it is that the ten northern tribes were taken away from his son Rehoboam, is not noted in 1 Chronicles. It simply notes that there is a rebellion, that Jeroboam took the ten northern tribes and Rehoboam only had the two southern tribes. It doesn't explain why all that happened. But the 1 Kings chapter 11 does. We're told that King Solomon, verse 1, loved many foreign women. Loved the women. We won't go into Lady Godiva again. We talked about that with Dennis last night. He did a good job of explaining that. But here was, you think about this with regard to these two kings, David and Solomon. Here was an Achilles heel with both of them. Is the fact that they did not control themselves with regard to their affections for women, who they should not have. In this case, of course, it was typical of that time, a way of, in which King Solomon did facilitate the establishment of his kingdom and the alliances that were made by taking wives, taking foreign wives. And so King Solomon, we're told, loved many foreign women, as well as the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Edomites, the Sidonians, and the Hittites. These were all the various tribes and the peoples that God said that were to be utterly destroyed. But instead, they had been living side by side with the Israelites. From the nations of whom the Lord had said to the children of Israel, you shall not intermarry with them, nor they with you. Surely they will turn away your hearts after their gods. Solomon clung to these in love. Solomon clung to these in love. He had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines. And notice verse 3, his wives turned away his heart. His wives turned away his heart. I've got so many discussion questions that we can use to talk about this. I do want you to just very quickly note what happened as a result of that. In verse 4, we're told, it was so that when Solomon was old, that his wives turned his heart after other gods. And this is the way in which they corrupted him. They turned away his heart from God. He had just said, you have kept all your promises, God, and you keep your promises to those who serve you with all their heart. There's the king. Where are your loyalties? Where is your heart? They turned his heart away from the Lord his God. The heart of David was pure and righteous throughout his service to God. But Solomon, we're told, verse 6, he did evil in the sight of the Lord in this idolatry and did not fully follow the Lord as his father David did. And as a result of that, he booked high places to offer up sacrifices to those gods. And I want you to notice, verse 11, because of this, the Lord said to Solomon, because you've done this and have not kept my covenant and my statutes which I've commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom away. It says, oh no, I thought it said fear the kingdom away, and I knew that wasn't right, but that's just a mess up on my page. But it says, I'll tear the kingdom away from you and give it to your servant. Notice, nevertheless, I will not do it in your days. Now his servant was Jeroboam. I won't do it in your days for the sake of your father. I will tear it out of the hand of your son. However, I will not tear away the whole kingdom. I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I've chosen. So, he took it away because of his disobedience, but the throne never departed from Judah. And of course, we find that finally in this fulfilled the Messianic prophecy. So, even in this, though they disappointed him and Solomon did wrong and disobeyed, nevertheless, he maintained his promise, his ultimate promise with regard to the Messianic fulfillment that we'll talk about on Friday night. Okay, too much time. I don't have time to go into all those discussion questions. A couple of points that I want to make, and then we'll draw this lesson to a close. Surely we can see the danger of marrying someone who's not a Christian, based upon what happened to Solomon. So the young adults who are in the congregation, consider that very carefully. If you heed ungodly counsel for too long, it will turn your heart and your mind away from God. And that's exactly what happened with Solomon. There's a real danger in marrying someone who's not a Christian. There is danger today of idolatry. Not the same kind of idolatry, but we need to warn against it, just like they warned about it there in that century because idolatry is the placing of something, anything, in the place of God, to where it has the first place in your heart. God blesses those who turn to Him and serve Him with all their heart. If you have divided loyalties, that is placing an idol, whatever it may be. It may be money, it may be friendship, it may be wife or husband, no matter what. You put that before God. You are making that into an idol. So we need to warn about idolatry today. And then, The recognize that no matter how good you are, no matter how righteous you might live your life, number one, there is the danger of apostasy. And number two, that your standing with God can be forfeit if you turn away from Him at any point in time in your life. And we talked about that. We mentioned Ezekiel, the 18th chapter. I would encourage you to take the time to read that, because he indicates, again, that if an individual repents, turns away from his ungodliness, as David did, confesses that I have sinned against you, God, and turns back and does the right thing, that God would receive him and restore him. But having said that, if you do like Solomon did and not follow fully the Lord as did David, to turn away, that an individual can lose his standing with God as a result of that. Of course, the same thing is true in our day and time as well. It is as the proverb, a dog returns to his own vomit and a sow to her wallowing in the mire. It would be better for an individual not to have tasted the blessings that we have in Christ Jesus than, having done so, to turn away. The latter end is worse than the beginning. That's apostasy. And that is shown that it is possible. So, wanted to emphasize those things and recognize, again, if we're going to discuss the failings of Solomon, wow, look at it. Wonderful, successful leader, the most accomplished of all the kings. Israel reached its apex during his rule and reign. But the one fatal flaw is he heeded the counsel of foreign wives and turned away into idolatry. And as a result of that, his sin precipitated the ultimate demise of the people of God, both in the Assyrian captivity and the Babylonian captivity. Okay? Lots of material. I didn't do as good a job of covering it exactly like Dennis did. He timed it perfect. I didn't. Josiah, I think, will be able to get through tomorrow, but we'll look forward to that. Thank you for your kind attention today.